This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. The most memorable interviews and listener calls from the week that was on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Welcome to the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Saturday edition of the Best of Fight Back from the week that was. Executing on the Ford PC's budget announcement last month of $2 billion for home care was a topic of discussion on Monday with our Zoomer squad. It's great news for CARP members who've been advocating for making home care a priority as we age. It's also a much more inexpensive way to care for older Canadians who need some assistance but still want to live in their homes. That's where Libby began the conversation with Rudy Boutignol, president of CARP, John Wright, executive vice president of Maru Public Opinion, and Anthony Quinn, CARP's chief community officer.
It's a tremendous response from the provincial government that has been asked by CARP and by a number of other groups interested in the care and of seniors in their own homes. So $2 billion over 3 years, on top of another billion that came out post-COVID when we saw the need for having people remain in their own homes. So that will go towards funding PSWs, transportation for seniors, assisted help in a home, and day programs. So that type of money was on the priority list for CARP in 2022. At the election time, we listed the CARP 5, and home care was our number one ask. So we're delighted that the province has responded.
The response from the NDP opposition leader, the first response was, there's nothing in this budget for anyone. And I had quite a long talk with her on Thursday, on this show last Thursday, and she didn't quite say that. She was saying things like, well, it depends how it's spent, which obviously it does depend how it's spent.
Now, one of my personal concerns about home care with my own parents is that the province is funding agencies who are taking a profit themselves before they send out those workers. So if the PSWs could become part of the healthcare system directly in the future, I think that would be a way to get the best from our tax dollars.
John Wright, in terms of polling, I mean, that's one of the things I think that crop up in your polls all the time, people wanting to age in place, to age at home.
We all want to age in a place that we call a dwelling. I'm not sure a long-term care bed is what I would call a dwelling, as defined now by the government. But of course, they want to stay there. The question for me, being a bit of a cynic nowadays about all of this sort of stuff, is that what we hear from government constantly is what they teach you when you're going to be making a speech, and that is, tell them what you're going to tell them what you told them, and sit down, without actually delivering anything. So the question in my mind is always, and I think for a large part of the population, you can say you're going to deliver $2 billion, you can stand up and actually state it clearly that you're going to deliver it and sit down, but the question is whether it's going to flow through, and what is the priority of that, and how are you going to resource it? So I guess, you know, whether you're doing polling on it or you're going to be on the receiving end, you're a bit skeptical that what the government promises nowadays is actually going to end up working. Let's remember, this is also the government that promised a whole set of developments for new homes, and they are so far off their targets, it's just not going to happen. So I'll believe it when it's actually working in the home care sector.
Right, and part of that money, of course, you have to re-elect them to get it. That's a thing that the Liberals keep doing, too. It's always, you know, the devil is in the details, and I think that we're all getting a little bit skeptical about this stuff. But, hey, $2 billion for home care for something people want.
It's what they want, and it also leads to savings down the healthcare train. If you can be cared for in your home, then you're not going to ER on a regular basis. You're not backing up the lineups in ER. You're not stuck in a bed waiting for additional institutional care and long-term care. It's the smart way to invest healthcare dollars.
And Rudy, does CARP have any plans to hold them to it?
Well, we lobbied the government. It was part of our position in the last provincial election. This is a huge win for CARP, but clearly the government is listening, and they respond to the need of home care. That's what overwhelmingly almost everyone wants. The devil's in the details. It's about delivery. And we've seen with our federal government and other governments that it seems to be government by press release. It's like, great, what's the plan? How are you going to deliver? When are you going to deliver it? And how much is it going to cost? That seems to be where things are stuck. And that's where I think you spoke to a need for culture change. That needs to change so that we get these services to where they're needed. Home care, it's a win for CARP. It's a win for seniors. And right now, we're going to take that.
Rudy Boutignol, president of CARP, Anthony Quinn, CARP's chief community officer, and John Wright, executive vice president of Maru Public Opinion. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. The much-hyped, once-in-a-lifetime total solar eclipse is set to take place on Monday afternoon. It's believed Niagara Falls will receive as many as 1 million people, as that city will offer optimal viewing of the celestial event. Niagara region decision makers have declared a state of emergency ahead of the eclipse. But is that the best solution? This past Monday, Libby was joined for a discussion by Natalie Preddy, travel expert and travel freelance writer, and Jim Diodati, mayor of Niagara Falls.
It does give us another chance to remind people to come prepared, you know, gas tanks filled and medication and comfortable shoes and all the things they need to do. And also, apparently, it allows the regional government to access provincial and federal funds for the extra police and ambulance and fire staff and whatnot that'll be deployed for that big event. I understand the concern because I'm sure as the roads get jammed up, ways and the GPS will direct people onto back streets and side roads, and it's going to impact the entire region. The entire region is in the path of totality. So regardless, there's going to be a massive crowds here, and they're going to be coming from all different directions, even along the U.S. border. They've got signs they put up a while ago warning people of extended delays and be patient and come prepared and bring your glasses, things like that. So, you know, it's a good question. I mean, obviously, we'll have lots of Monday morning quarterbacks, or in this case, Tuesday morning quarterbacks, who will, you know, dissect what happened. But again, regardless, it'll be the biggest event in the city's history.
The effect that it might have would be to convince a lot of people not to go to Niagara Falls, and that might be a desirable thing, Jim Diodati.
So that's a good point, and there's two sides to it. So on one end, it's given a whole bunch of extra media coverage, including in the U.S. along their major media channels. So that's on one end. It's actually drawing more attention, almost like a moth to the flame. But on the other side, I can tell you, I did receive a contact from the Hotel Motel Association that there are still rooms available, that there have been some last minute cancellations because of the emergency announcement. So I guess it's a good news, bad news thing. Now for people looking for rooms, there's actually reasonably placed rooms that are available in the city for the weekend, because it will be a long weekend because there will be no school on the Monday, and a good chance for some families to get away after the winter.
Well, the other thing I heard is that, you know, there's a lot of personal entrepreneurship, people renting out their driveways or their backyards. What happens in a case like that if somebody can't get to the spot that they paid money for, and it's, you know, whether it's an actual tourism business or a person trying to make a few extra bucks, Natalie?
I think, you know, it's really people taking advantage of the extreme number of people that are going to be there. But saying that, I mean, I've seen so many hotels that are going to be in the line of the eclipse everywhere, from, you know, the States around San Antonio where it's going to be, and across Canada. I know Marriott has been offering lots of solar eclipse deals. So, you know, come stay for the solar eclipse package. And, you know, they've been offering, you know, two nights for the price of three, or you know, we're going to offer A, B, and C. So I've seen across the tourism industry, people are absolutely making the most of this and absolutely creating packages around this, offering goggles, So I think, you know, from a marketing tourism agency point of view, it is helpful for those in the line of the eclipse. And, you know, in Niagara Falls, those that are renting out their backyard for campers, you know, they've just kind of hopped onto that trend.
And Natalie, what's your advice to people who are thinking of braving the traffic and the crowds and everything else?
As travel consumers, we're looking for experiences that are outside, that are memorable, that, you know, we're collecting memories instead of things. And I think this is going to be a fantastic opportunity to create an amazing memory. So by all means, head down and take public transit, avoid that parking lot or QEW, whatever you'd like to call it, and just really make the most of what Niagara Falls has got going on, because it does sound like it's going to be a fantastic weekend.
Natalie Preddy, travel expert and travel freelance writer, and Jim Diodati, mayor of Niagara Falls. You're listening to the best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up after the break, the Liberals' pre-budget campaign is on, just as MPs get a big raise. We discuss next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Good isn't good enough. Make way for the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. The Trudeau Liberals have started their pre-budget campaign, which included an event on Monday when the Prime Minister announced a five-year, billion-dollar school food program. That event came a few days after we heard about his new Renters' Bill of Rights, a measure that has been largely mocked, and an attempt to win back younger voters who appear to be flocking to Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives. The announcement of the school food program also came on the same day as the carbon tax increased. While the Liberals try to push the message that most people will get back more in rebates than they pay in the tax. At the same time, cost of living salary hikes kicked in with 4.4% increases for members of parliament, cabinet ministers, and the prime minister. So an MP now has a base salary of well over $200,000, while the federal election date has been moved forward a week, which is a pension-friendly move for MPs. Libby talked about the issues with our Recovering Politicians panel on Tuesday. Sherry DeNovo is a former Ontario NDP MPP. Lisa Raitt is a former deputy leader of the Conservative Party of Canada. And George Smitherman is a former Ontario Liberal cabinet minister.
It's pretty clear that the prime minister picked up the pace. And I think even before he was rolling out some of the goodies from the budget, he was already on a very active Canada-wide tour. And, you know, I'd have to say, obviously, the fortunes of the party are not great. We've spoken about that every week, I'm pretty sure. But at the same time, they're using all the power that is available to them as the government to put their best foot forward. And I think it's going, you know, reasonably well. We'll see if it has any impact in polling. But, you know, I think for Liberals, they could at least see that the leader is out and about and setting the pattern with respect to news. And he's definitely getting all about the country. So, you know, I think it's showing a good level of activism on the part of the government, and that's the best hope that they've got.
Lisa, is it going to work, especially with the younger voters that it seems to be targeted at?
Don't think so. I agree with George. I think that this is what they're doing in terms of trying to get ahead of an issue. I would say, from my partisan view, it smacks a bit of desperation, and it is an attempt just to do as much as possible. But remember, all of this stuff is only possible because of taxpayer dollars. And there's a lot of money being put out the door again to try to solve problems that came about during their time. And I'm hoping that some of it works. I like what I saw in the housing announcement, because there's a lot of stuff in there that was in a report that I was lucky enough to be part of. And I think that's positive. But I get concerned when these announcements are being made with no real understanding of how they're going to get implemented or executed. And it can be a case where a promise on a very important topic like hunger and food in schools is more of a moment to try to stem a downturn as opposed to getting all the premiers together, figuring out the right way to implement this and having one big announcement on something as important as that.
Sherry, in terms of this food program, it has, as I said, received pretty well good reviews. And unlike most of their programs, they even seem to put an implementation date on it. Usually you have to elect them twice more to get any action.
You're so right, Libby. I mean, that's been the liberal, process is, lots of promises, but we need another election, two or three, before you'll see any action on any of it. I think the communications that's coming out of Ottawa from the Trudeau camp is just abysmal. I mean, imagine giving MPs a huge raise when most Canadians are suffering to 200,000 plus on April Fool's. One in four children are hungry and need the food. Yes, they do. But again, this is a promise. This is all kind of wing and prayer stuff. I don't think they really get the real question is, so why didn't you do this before? Why are you doing it now? I mean, I think of all the liberal promises from, getting rid of first past the post. Remember, Trudeau said be the last election ever under that system. Pharmacare. These are all liberal promises we still don't really see. We're getting some drugs, but I mean, it's not really a pharmacare program the way that it was promised to be, again, a couple of elections, So, I mean, I think people are just very fed up with this, and particularly, the way that the communications around the carbon tax have gone out, which couldn't be worse, could not be worse. Again, somebody needs to be held to account, and they don't seem to be in the Trudeau government.
Sherry DeNovo, former Ontario NDP MPP. Lisa Raitt, former deputy leader of the Federal Conservatives, and George Smitherman, a former Ontario Liberal cabinet minister. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. There was a horrible development this past week in the Israel-Hamas war when seven aid workers, including a dual Canadian-American citizen, were killed in Gaza by an Israeli airstrike. Israeli defense and political leaders have acknowledged it was an unintended strike that killed the aid workers with World Food Kitchen and have promised an independent investigation. Since the tragic event, two IDF officers have been fired and three have been reprimanded following an initial investigation. The day after the strike happened, Libby was joined by three experts to discuss. Uriel Abulov is a senior lecturer at Tel Aviv University's Department of Political Science. Vivian Berkovich is a Canadian lawyer, academic, and former ambassador of Canada to Israel. And Jonathan Conricus is a former spokesperson for the Israeli Defense Forces.
I think it's doubly tragic that this sad event happened today, because it really it's a wrench in the wheel or a wrench in the machinery. And the organization said that they are now suspending operations, which is, of course, would be very dangerous for lots of Palestinians who really acutely need the food here. And really what's at stake here is the current ability to provide food to Palestinians in need and how the day after fighting in Gaza will look like, where every humanitarian organization that is positively inclined and really is there for humanitarian purposes, unlike UNRWA and many organizations who are there but have failed the Palestinians and their humanitarian needs, every one of those organizations will be needed, and Israel will have to be responsible to make sure and to be extra super careful that this never happens again, because once is a mistake and it probably can be eventually tolerated. But at the end of the day, I don't think that Israel can or has enough, international diplomatic currency, so to say, to go through this again.
Vivian, what do you see as the impact of this on the whole situation? As I said, here in Canada, Foreign Minister Melanie Joly condemned this airstrike. Does it put Israel in a worse position?
Well, it certainly doesn't put Israel in a better position. It's a very delicate time. It's a horrific time, and it's a tragic mistake. Does it put Israel in a more difficult position? It certainly increases the international scrutiny and pressure. With respect to Minister Foreign Affairs Melanie Jolie, I don't read much into her comment. She is always quick to jump on anything where Israel is or may be implicated. She has jumped on occasions in the past where the issue that she condemned turned out to be a rumor, completely untrue. So she has this reflexive response to anything that involves Israel, and I'll let that sort of speak for itself. And Canada, I think, is important, but, you know, I think that the way in which countries like Germany, France, the UK, and the US react are going to be much more telling. And let's not forget that in war theaters, tragic mistakes happen. And I think we all remember there was one horrific error involved the United States and Afghanistan, where there were scores who were killed in a hospital hit. A totally inadvertent, tragic, terrible mistake for which the U.S. appropriately apologized. And these things happen, and it's terrible.
Uriel, Netanyahu has ignored some of the demands by the Americans. There are increasing calls in the United States for them to take action against this government. How is this divide being viewed in the country, and what do you make of it?
Ignoring what the administration has been saying is a sort of an understatement in this context. Both Netanyahu and his coalition and many other people in the media, Israeli media, who belong to that camp has effectively been mocking Biden, although they should be extremely grateful for all the help that Biden has been offering Israel over nearly half a year now in its struggle. Now, the thing is that the current government does not have a geopolitical strategy for the day after. They would not like to see a day after, especially Netanyahu, who would like to see the war lingering. And it is possible that the escalation in the north is part of that. Now, Israel direly needs the U.S. on its side in fighting against Hezbollah and Iran. And there is no way to go about it without also addressing the Palestinian issue, which is something that Netanyahu and his government has been trying to avoid in every way possible, unless you count those extreme messianic elements in the government wanting basically to control all the land from the river to the sea as a sort of strategy. And we are stuck at that point without a real substantial coalition, not just between Israel and the U.S., but other moderate powers in the world and in the region itself. And there are such moderate powers. Israel is looking towards a very dire future.
Uriel Abulov is a senior lecturer at Tel Aviv University's Department of Political Science. Vivian Berkovich is a Canadian lawyer, academic, and former ambassador of Canada to Israel. And Jonathan Conricus is a former spokesperson for the Israeli Defense Forces. You're listening to the best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Still to come, what you had to say about the week that was and the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Zoomer Radio, pulling no punches with the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer has the most informed guests on the week's hot topics. And we also rely on you for your valued opinions. Here are some of this week's best calls. Jim in Brampton called about being asked to sign a do not resuscitate order, which he flatly refused to do.
I've been asked to sign the DNR twice, even though I'm only 75 years old, but I was asked to sign it twice in two different times and then emerge. And I thought, what's going on here? He said, well, he said, if you sign the DNR, you'll go quietly. And I said, no, I'm going to kick and scream.
And now, Fight Back's Knockout Call of the Week.
There were a lot of great calls this week, but the winner of the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week is actually one of our medical record panelists, Dr. Malcolm Moore, whose reaction to Rudy in Toronto during our segment on colon cancer is priceless.
I'm actually calling for a friend of mine, because this is coincidentally, because she just recently went for a colonoscopy and they couldn't do it because she couldn't digest all the fluid that they had her to drink before that, as they said there was still stuff in her bowels.
Oh, okay.
So I'm wondering if there is a way that she can get a colonoscopy, or there's a clinic that can do it without her having to drink that fluid.
That actually speaks to your first comment, which is that a lot of people do not go through screening for colonoscopy because the prep is honestly a pain in the ass, if you excuse
the pun.
It's very difficult and uncomfortable. But unless you can clean out the colon, and that's what the preps are forced to do, then if there's still stool in the colon, then the person doing the colonoscopy really can't visualize small cancer. So it's an inevitable part of the colonoscopy sequence, and is the reason why people are looking at other ways of screening.
That does it for today's Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. If you'd like to qualify for the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week, phone us noon to one weekdays. Or if you have a comment, email us at fightback@zoomer.ca. Follow us on X at @FightbackLibby. And call our Fight Back voicemail anytime at 416-367-9636. I'm Jane Brown. Join me again at the same time tomorrow when we'll round up the rest of the Best of Fight Back.
Best of Fight Back is produced by Jane Brown, Ziv Hadi, and Dan Christakos. Technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Neimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.